Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group is hosting a podcast with Clark Neely, senior attorney with the Institute for Justice, on Locke v. Erig, a case that implicates economic liberty and free speech. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And with that, please give us your opening remarks, Mr. Neely.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about this very interesting and challenging question. The issue in this case, basically, this is a challenge to a Florida law that requires people to have a license in order to engage in the practice of interior design. Florida is one of only three states in the entire country where it is literally a crime. You can go to jail for practicing interior design without a license from the state. Now, among many problems with that approach, a really significant problem is that interior design is a fundamentally expressive occupation. In other words, interior designers are not paid for anything that they do. They don't produce products. They're not really providing a service in the sense of manual labor. Interior designers share ideas for how a space might work better or look better given the knowledge that they have and the information they collect about a particular person or business. And here's why that's such a challenge. When you're talking about jobs, about vocations in which the product is nothing more than speech, it's just the expression of ideas on the part of the practitioner, the question is, does a regulation of that speech fall into the free speech constitutional category, or should it fall into the economic liberty category? And the reason that matters so much is that the Supreme Court takes vastly different approaches to evaluating laws that interfere with free speech on the one hand versus laws that interfere with somebody's ability to make a living on the other. So then the question presented by this case is, what about a law that interferes with both of those? And that's exactly what Florida's law regulating the practice of interior design does. For those who don't know much about the vocation of interior design, just a sort of a quick background on it. Interior design is an occupation that covers a wide spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, it's highly aesthetic and artistic. Some of the most famous interior designers in the world really don't do a lot of technical design. They're not there to lay out space for you or to ensure code compliance. They're artists. They're sharing a vision for how your hotel or your office or your home should look, and they're communicating that vision to you, and it's a fundamentally artistic vision. And then that's the service, in effect, that you're paying them for. At the other end of the spectrum, interior design can be quite technical. It can be about code compliance. It can be about laying out spaces in a way that is ergonomic and basically creates an efficient workspace. The problem in Florida, as in the other two states that regulate the practice of interior design, is that no effort whatsoever has been made to differentiate any of that. In other words, Florida's interior design law does not just apply to interior design speech that results in, for example, the obtaining of a building permit or the creation of a highly technical design drawing. It applies to any design, drawing, consultation, or study relating to the interior elements of a building or space. So everything within the four walls of a building that is not actually holding the building up, and we're talking about everything from the carpets on the floor to the artwork on the walls to the color of paint, all of that is covered by the literal language of Florida's interior design law. And that makes it really challenging to essentially determine what is the right constitutional doctrine to evaluate this law. And let me try to put it in context just so people get a sense of the challenge here. Imagine you had a law that says you have to have a license from the government to be a journalist, to write newspaper columns or to write stories in newspapers. everybody understands that that would have serious First Amendment implications, and that would not be analyzed merely as a regulation of an occupation or profession. That would be analyzed as a burden on core First Amendment speech, and it would receive the high level of scrutiny that we normally associate with First Amendment regulations regulations of speech that implicate the First Amendment. The same would obviously be true if there was a law that required a license to be a portrait artist, or a sculptor, or a photographer. All of those clearly implicate First Amendment free speech values, or a political consultant, for that matter. Then the question becomes, does there come a point at which particular vocations, particular occupations, even though they are purely expressive, in other words, you are only paying the practitioner for the expression of ideas, does there come a point at which certain vocations essentially lose their inherent expressive qualities that would normally trigger robust First Amendment scrutiny and become nothing more than just vocations, nothing more than a profession that is then evaluated according to the so-called rational basis standard, which is no standard at all. I mean, the rational basis test is just a fraud parading as a constitutional standard review. It's nothing of the kind. It's just a big fat rubber stamp that the judiciary essentially applies to laws to which it doesn't want to give any meaningful scrutiny. So that's why the question matters so much, is that essentially if you have a regulation, a vocational regulation, and you can convince the court that it is fundamentally a regulation of expressive speech, the way you would be able to do, for example, if it was a licensing scheme for newspaper journalists, then you're going to get a fairly high level of scrutiny, and the state is actually going to have to show that there's some genuine problem that they're trying to address and that they've made a reasonable effort to tailor the licensing requirement to that problem. And they'll actually have to establish that with evidence, and it will be their burden to do so. On the other hand, if the court characterizes the regulation as merely a regulation of a vocation or a profession, then you won't get the First Amendment scrutiny. You'll instead get the rational basis review that applies to occupational licensing regulations. And that's no scrutiny whatsoever. You'll essentially just have a court go through the motions of pretending to review the law and then just reaching the result that they almost invariably reach in these cases, which is to just rubber stamp it. The government will not be required to identify any serious or sincere reason for the regulation. They will not be required to present any evidence to support the regulation. And in fact, under rational basis review, the government is invited and in fact encouraged to just make up possible explanations or justifications for the law, even if they have nothing whatever to do with the enactment of law. And even a step further, if the government lawyers run out of creativity, then the judges are supposed to get involved and help the government think of reasons why it might have enacted the law, again, even if those reasons have nothing whatsoever to do with the actual enactment of the law. And that's precisely what has happened in the Florida Interior Design case, is that both in the district court and at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, the courts basically characterized the law not as a regulation of expressive or of expression, but instead as merely a vocational regulation to which the rational basis test applies, and there follows no meaningful judicial review whatsoever. And how do we know this? Well, in this case, incredibly, the state actually stipulated. We have stipulated facts from the state that it has no evidence that the unregulated practice of interior design presents any genuine public policy concerns, and the state also stipulated that it has no evidence that the licensing of interior designers has benefited the public in any way. Now, basically, under any meaningful standard of review, including any standard of review under the First Amendment, no matter whether we're talking about intermediate scrutiny, central Hudson for commercial speech, or anything else, those stipulations would be fatal, because in effect the government has admitted it just doesn't have any evidence of any need to regulate in this area, and it can't identify any genuine public policy concern. The only way a law could survive in the face of those stipulations would be under rational basis review, where the government doesn't have to have any evidence, it doesn't have to have a sincere explanation for the law, and it doesn't have to identify any genuine problem that the law is intended to address. And that's what it's done in this case. The state has suggested, notwithstanding its stipulations, that there's a need to regulate interior design because unlicensed interior design can lead to certain unspecified safety concerns. We know that's completely ridiculous. Among other things, 47 states in this country do not regulate interior designers, and there have been no problems whatsoever as a result. So filed our cert petition earlier this fall, and it's now ripe. We expect to hear from the court in the first week of January. And the reason why we think this case is cert-worthy, and we're really excited about this case in particular, is that it really presents an intriguing kind of collision of two very different lines of case law. So you've got the economic liberty line of case law, where the court essentially requires the government to make no meaningful showing in order to justify a law that restricts a person's ability to earn a living. You've got that line of case law colliding with the court's expressive or First Amendment jurisprudence for expressive conduct, for speech, in which the government actually does have to justify the law with a sincere explanation and actual evidence, which it's already stipulated that it cannot do in this case. And so this is a case where the court will, if it takes the case, will have to sort of wrestle with how to resolve the tension between those two lines of jurisprudence, one where it completely lets the government off the hook and doesn't subject the challenged regulation to any meaningful level of review whatsoever, and another line of precedent where it actually does care about things like evidence and reason and the actual facts of the case. And so obviously we've tried to position this case as a regulation of expression. When you hire an interior designer, you are not hiring that person to create a product or to engage in any sort of manual labor. You are paying that person for their ideas, for the expression of those ideas through in writing, in speech, and in drawings. That's all expression. And the Supreme Court has made very clear that the regulation of expression receives a meaningful level of scrutiny under the First Amendment. And so it's tremendously important sort of which doctrinal box the speech goes in. And the Supreme Court, believe it or not, is completely at sea on that question. Essentially, what is the proper way to evaluate professional or vocational regulations that implicate expressive occupations or that regulate expressive occupations? And a number of very prominent First Amendment scholars, including Eugene Volokh, have noted that this is one of the least developed areas of the Supreme Court's First Amendment doctrine. And the lower courts are really been at sea. There's just no guidance on this. And what they've done is essentially fallen back on a 1985 concurring opinion by Justice White in a case called Lowe v. SEC, in which completely in dicta, and again in a concurring opinion that has never been cited, let alone endorsed by the Supreme Court, Justice White essentially reasoned that if a particular vocation or a particular profession involves the giving of direct advice to somebody on the basis of knowledge and learning, and you take the affairs of a client directly in hand, then that would be so-called professional speech to which the First Amendment would not apply. I think there's a lot of problems with conceptualizing it that way, and that may explain why the Supreme Court has never embraced that doctrine. But at least four lower courts have done so, and this has created a tremendous amount of confusion in the lower courts. As we document in our cert petition, we have courts applying everything from no scrutiny whatsoever, as in our case, all the way up to strict scrutiny for occupational regulations that regulate occupations in which the whole product is just the expression of ideas. So we hope the Supreme Court will take the case. We think it really presents a very interesting constitutional conflict and one that is desperately in need of resolution because the lower courts are so obviously at sea on this very, very important question.
Well, thank you very much. Let's get to a couple questions now, if we could. First of all, you mentioned, a circuit split. You mentioned that lower courts are all over the map in terms of their jurisprudence. I wonder, are these laws on the increase or are they declining? And do many or most of them include a criminal component, as does the Florida statute?
They absolutely are on the increase, and that only makes sense if you think about it, because America is moving into the information age, and more Americans are going to be earning a living in jobs that just involve the expression of ideas. Fewer and fewer Americans are going to be in the manufacturing sector or the manual labor sector. And so as more and more Americans earn a living in jobs where, you know, you're just expressing yourself, there's going to be more and more regulations of this kind. And let's not, you know, make any bones about it. These laws come about as a direct result of lobbying efforts on the part of people who want to exclude competition. That's precisely how Florida's interior design law got on the books. And that pressure, that kind of public choice-based pressure, is not going to let up. If anything, it will only increase.
And do most of the laws include a criminal component, which seems a bit astounding to me?
They do. That is absolutely typical, that the violation of a law of this kind is typically a misdemeanor. Now, it's not generally enforced that way. Usually these laws are enforced through the imposition of fines. In fact, in Florida, the fines have been quite substantial. They actually fined two of the most famous interior designers in the country $10,000 and $15,000, respectively, for offering to practice interior design in Florida without a license. So the criminal component is always there as a sort of an additional interorum vehicle for the state, but it appears that the imposition of substantial fines has been enough to get the word out, at least in this instance.
And under, you know, including the Florida law, including some of the other laws, if you can speak to those, how difficult is it for someone to obtain a license? Is it just checking off a couple boxes, or is it costly in terms of funds, in terms of time?
To get an interior design license in Florida, as in other states, is incredibly difficult, incredibly onerous. It takes a combined 6 years of college education at an approved school and up to 2 or 3 years of apprenticeship for a state-licensed interior designer. We estimate the cost of this to be between $80,000 and $100,000. It takes 6 years of your life, and then after that, you actually have to pass a two-day, $1,000 interior design licensing exam that's very much like a bar exam that lawyers would take. So it's extraordinarily difficult to get a license. And this further underscores that the point here is not really to regulate who can practice interior design. It's not to protect the public. This law has one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to protect established interior designers from fair competition. And it's been very effective in doing that.
Let me get to two more questions, if I could. One is really fact-specific, and it goes to the Florida statute.
Yeah.
What if you have some kind of split business? I'm wondering if this would apply. You know, you run a commercial moving van service, and your guys get to the destination, start unpacking the truck, and make suggestions to the business as to where they place their furniture and how they
yep.
do that. Would this statute apply to something like that?
Absolutely. One of the real problems with Florida's interior design law is that it is so broadly written that by its literal terms, it applies to many, many jobs that aren't interior design. So, for example, one of the reasons why this really came to a head in Florida is that the state was applying this law to office furniture suppliers who routinely provide a kind of a drawing or a schematic to show how their furniture that they're selling you should be installed. And the state was literally going after these office furniture dealers just for making those drawings that they had always made and routinely had made. And that is a huge problem with the law. Now, in the course of the litigation, the state sort of realized what a problem that was and completely disavowed that conduct. I thought it did so in a very unconvincing and insincere way, because if you actually look at the years and years of enforcement history, the state repeatedly went after office furniture dealers and tried to shut them down for doing nothing more than just providing, you know, a drawing showing how to install the furniture that they were selling you. So yes, it's been a tremendous problem for people who are not actually interior designers and don't consider themselves to be interior designers, but part of whose job clearly falls within the incredibly broad definition of interior design in Florida, which, again, the definition is interior design means drawings, diagrams, studies, consultations relating to the interior elements of a building or space, and that is everything. So it's a huge, huge problem.
And is any part of the case Since there is a criminal component of the statute, does it rely on any kind of void for vagueness assertion since the statute is so broad?
We did raise a void for vagueness argument, and the challenge, of course, there is that if the courts evaluate void for vagueness challenges under two different standards, depending on whether the law that's being challenged is a regulation of speech, in which case, again, they'll give a fairly robust level of review, or if it's not a regulation of speech, essentially you have to prove that the law would be vague in all of its applications and could not be understood by a reasonable person in any application. Of course, that's virtually impossible to do. I thought we had a very strong argument for void for vagueness under the First Amendment, but in our case, as I mentioned before, the lower courts refused to treat the law as a regulation of speech, even though it quite clearly is. And so we were not successful on the void for vagueness challenge because we weren't able to get the case within that sort of First Amendment doctrinal box. That's what we're working on doing at the Supreme Court level.
Great. Now, I wonder if you want to, I know litigators in particular are reluctant to get into prognostication, but I wonder if you want to give us any analysis at all on how you might see individual justices
sure.
work through these issues.
Well, you know, it's certainly a challenge to sort of try to predict or prognosticate how individual justices might handle this, but one of the things that's been very encouraging is that the court has, I would say both the liberals and conservatives on the court seem to be in agreement that cases raising significant First Amendment issues are deserving of careful attention from the court, even if those issues come up in a setting where the speech is paid for. So, for example, we have recently, just last term, we have the Sorrell case involving the payment for basically sort of data mining in the pharmaceutical market. We have two terms ago, we have the Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project, where there's a federal law that essentially made it a crime to give advice or assistance to designated terrorist organizations. Now, that law was upheld, but only after being subjected to rigorous First Amendment scrutiny. And then we have the Stevens v. United States dogfighting case. This was a case involving a guy who sold CDs, a portion of which happened to feature pit bulls fighting. He presented them as a documentary, but the government charged him under a federal animal cruelty law, and the U.S. Supreme Court evaluated that as a free speech issue and determined that the law was in fact vague and overbroad. So we think this case actually fits neatly within the sort of the arc of that First Amendment jurisprudence. And again, it raises an issue that is just crying out for resolution because you have lower courts invoking this, you know, 25-year-old concurring opinion by Justice White that the Supreme Court itself has never even cited. So the lower courts are at sea. It involves a very important issue of First Amendment, kind of first impression, First Amendment question, and one that commentators have acknowledged as one of the least developed areas of First Amendment case law. So I think that given the arc of precedent that I've just described, both the more traditionally liberal justices and the more traditionally conservative justices will hopefully, you know, sort of come together and recognize that this is a genuine free speech issue and needs to be treated more seriously and given a higher level of scrutiny than the lower courts have done so far.
Well, thank you, Clark Neely, and thank you to our audience for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you very much.